Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. I'm David Bowes, your host. For some time, critics have dismissed intelligent design proponents by asserting there are no peer-reviewed published papers supporting ID. Yet, intelligent design proponents recently celebrated crossing the 50-paper mark of published peer-reviewed papers dealing with intelligent design. Does that mean critics will stop with that attack? Probably not. But while that line of criticism against intelligent design is not a valid one, it does raise the question as to whether, in order for something to be legitimate science, must it first be published in a peer-reviewed journal? Here to talk about it with me is Casey Luskin of the Discovery Institute. Casey, does good science need to be published first in a peer-reviewed journal?
Well, I think the history of science shows the answer to that question is a definitive no. For example, some very famous scientists such as Copernicus or Newton originally published books on their major ideas that were not published in peer-reviewed journals. For those who are interested in the debate over evolution, Darwin's own theory of evolution was first published in a book for a general scientific audience, but not in a peer-reviewed paper. So it's definitely not the case that you have to publish something in a peer-reviewed journal for it to be good science. Even Einstein's theory of relativity did not originally appear in a peer-reviewed scientific paper.
Is it possible for good science to be rejected by the peer-reviewed journals then?
You know, this is something that is a very interesting question. As I was researching this recently, I did not expect to find that there would be so many examples of good scientific theories that actually were initially rejected by the peer-reviewed literature. There's actually a number of significant papers that have been rejected by top scientific journals like Science or Nature. And in fact, Nature has even rejected work that eventually earned the Nobel Prize. I found a paper by a scholar named Juan Miguel Campanario, who actually has studied a number of different instances where significant papers, significant ideas were initially rejected by leading scientific journals. So it is really surprising to hear this, but in fact, even some of the best scientific research has been initially rejected by the peer-reviewed literature.
Casey, didn't your post on Evolution News and Views also cite a paper from Stephen Hawking that was rejected that ended up being some of his most important work?
Yeah, that's right, David. I actually found an incident, an anecdote, when Stephen Hawking had submitted to Nature one of his most important papers on black holes. And of course, Hawking is very well known for his work on black holes, and initially that work was rejected. And this is just one of many examples. I mean, whether you're looking at plate tectonics or the Krebs cycle or, you know, work looking at all kinds of different scientific areas, we find examples where initially that work was rejected by leading scientific journals.
How have the courts approached this idea that science must be published in a peer-reviewed journal in order to be legitimate?
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court has actually found that it is not an absolutely necessary requirement for good science to be published in peer-reviewed literature. There was a landmark case in 1993, Daubert versus Merrill Dow Pharmaceuticals, where the U.S. Supreme Court was asked to assess the question of whether or not evidence that was permissible to admit in the course of a case had to be peer-reviewed. And previously there had been this test called the general acceptance test. But in this case, the U.S. Supreme Court actually ruled that you did not have to have general acceptance or necessarily did you have to have publication in a peer-reviewed journal in order for something to be good science. The court said that obviously publication in a peer-reviewed journal can sometimes help you assess whether or not something represents good science, but it is not an absolute indicator of good science. And so this is significant because essentially our legal system recognizes that yes, publication in a journal can be a good piece of evidence showing that something is good science, but it is not necessarily evidence that something is good science. And the court actually held, it said that, quote, publication, which is but one element of peer review, is not a sine qua non of admissibility. It does not necessarily correlate with reliability, and in some instances, well-grounded but innovative theories will not have been published. So there you have it. The U.S. Supreme Court said that you can have a good scientific theory that has not appeared in a scientific journal.
What are some of the problems that come from an over-reliance on peer-reviewed publication?
Well, there are two general criticisms of the peer-reviewed system. One is that the system wrongly rejects scientifically valid papers and the other is that the system wrongly accepts scientifically flawed papers. And so these sort of dual criticisms are very persistent, and we find obviously many anecdotes from people who will find that initially very valid papers were rejected, and then unfortunately sometimes papers are published that later turn out to have flaws. And there's all kinds of sort of human factors, you might say, that play into the peer review process that cause the system to not always weed out bad papers, or that sometimes cause it to reject good papers. A lot of them come down to basically personal politics, economic issues, personal self-interest, and just the fact that humans are not infallible. And these are human beings that are doing the review, and sometimes they make mistakes.
Is peer-reviewed publication necessary to prevent fraud and also to prevent flawed studies from being published? Even if some end up being published, wouldn't it be a greater disaster not to have it?
Well, this is one of those really tough questions. A lot of folks will argue that peer review is one of those necessary evils. It's the least bad system that we have. Obviously, you can't just accept everything that's submitted for publication. There has to be some way to ensure that it is of a certain quality, and you need to find a way to weed out fraudulent or flawed papers. At the same time, what happens when politics gets involved and the peer reviewers now become enforcers of orthodoxy who don't let new, innovative, groundbreaking ideas get published simply because they might buck the orthodoxy?
How can the pressure to publish end up pressuring scientists into doing bad science?
Well, there's definitely a culture in the scientific community today that has been often called the publish or perish mindset. And what this shows is that scientists are under a lot of pressure to publish their work. And this is understandable. You need to produce good science. You need to produce results in order to justify keeping your job. The problem is that under this pressure, sometimes folks are tempted to cut corners, and sometimes folks are tempted to help other people publish their papers, hoping that when they want their own papers published, others in the field will do the same for them. So there's sort of a all scratch your back, you scratch mine mentality. And what ends up happening is the imperfect peer review system is maintained by this publish or perish mindset. Because there's all this pressure to keep pumping out papers, you're going to have this peer reviewed system. It's going to be kept in place, and there's a lot of self-interest of the peer reviewed system to keep itself in place, because there's a whole economic system that's been built up around it.
How can reviewers be objective, or how do they fail to be objective? What kind of biases might they have, and are there any controls for them?
This is one of those really hard things. There's no control for human imperfection. Humans are going to be imperfect. Now, of course, when you submit a paper to the peer-reviewed journal, you're not going to usually just have one reviewer. You're going to have multiple reviewers. And the hope is that between, you know, maybe the three or four reviewers, maybe some of them will get it right. And if the reviewers have widely divergent responses to a paper, that might be evidence to the editor that he or she needs to really take a closer look and find out what's going on here. But the bottom line is you cannot control for human imperfection. We're not angels. We're not going to have perfect reviewers constantly reviewing papers. What I think really is the problem here is not papers undergo peer review. And in many cases, that's got to happen. The problem is when people start to use peer review as a weapon to either hurt their enemies or help their friends, and it no longer is the case that peer review is just about getting good papers in the journal and keeping bad papers out. It becomes more of a political tool, as I said earlier, to enforce an orthodoxy and maybe to prevent certain viewpoints from having their say. And when this political nature of peer review starts to come out, what you have happening is you have people starting to say, well, if this does not appear in a peer-reviewed journal, then we're not going to take it seriously. We're not even going to listen to you until you have published something in the peer-reviewed literature. And this becomes a real problem, because now that notion of peer review has sort of become this gold standard of infallibility, where it's considered to be something it isn't. And that is a perfect way to do science. And that's definitely not what peer review is. We need to keep in mind that peer review is always done by human beings. It's not perfect. It's not always going to be a perfect gold standard. And as the U.S. Supreme Court recognized, sometimes good scientific theories will not have been published. So we need to not treat peer review as sort of this infallible gospel that we cannot question, or that once it's published, there is absolutely perfect. We need to realize that this is a human enterprise, and that peer review, it works sometimes, but it's not perfect. And we need to also be willing to consider the possibility that peer review might be trying to enforce orthodoxy, and it might not always be letting new and innovative ideas have their say.
In your Evolution News and Views posting on this subject, you actually cited an example of one of the problems when peer review becomes a moral cause, that instead of focusing on the science of the paper, they focus on the potential political implications or the cause of the paper, and that's where some of that human fallibility comes from. When does that become a problem for a reviewer?
It's a temptation for reviewers who maybe are asking themselves, okay, this idea is not within the orthodoxy of my field. Do I let it get published? This is a real problem because people don't want to be seen as sort of fringe fanatics, or they don't want to be seen as people who are sort of letting their field down. And there's a lot of pressure to sort of maintain orthodoxy. What I'm saying right now is not controversial to historians of science. Historians of science have widely recognized that scientists are often intolerant to new ideas to challenge reigning paradigms. That's how old ideas maintain their status as the prevailing paradigm, is by sort of keeping new ideas from challenging them. And so defenders of the old guard in scientific fields will often not be open to publishing new scientific theories. But again, the problem is not necessarily that the peer review system exists. The problem is the way the peer review system is used to keep new ideas out and to sort of tell people that if it's not published in a peer review journal, then it by definition has no merit. One of the interesting anecdotes that came out as I was writing this little investigative piece was an incident that took place about a year ago. Some NASA scientists had claimed that they found arsenic-based life. And immediately when they published their paper in the journal Science, a number of scientists were highly critical of their claims. And they really said that this had been sloppy research. They had not justified their claims of arsenic-based life. Well, what happened next? Well, these NASA scientists who had published the paper said that they would not respond to any of the critics until they published their criticisms in the peer-reviewed literature. So essentially what they're saying is, well, we published our paper in a peer-reviewed journal, and until you publish your criticisms in a peer-reviewed journal, we're not going to respond to you. We're not even going to give you the time of day. We're not even going to defend our research to you. Well, when you realize what the NASA scientists have been doing, you realize how hypocritical this was, because the NASA scientists had been going around pushing their research as if it bolstered the case for extraterrestrial life in non-peer-reviewed venues and formats. They were going out to the media and to the press and claiming that this bolstered the case for extraterrestrial life. So basically, they felt that it was okay for them to push their ideas in non-peer-reviewed venues, but as soon as somebody critiques them in a non-peer-reviewed venue, they hold up the peer-review card and they say, we're not going to listen to you until you publish your response in a peer-reviewed journal. And there's some folks that pointed out this is very hypocritical of these NASA scientists to be willing to push their ideas in non-peer-reviewed venues, but then refuse to talk to those or respond to those who have not published their ideas in peer-reviewed venues. And this is really when peer review is at its worst. It's at its worst when it's being used as a tool to shut down discussion, to shut down dissent, and to prevent people from having open scientific dialogue over these important questions. And eventually, by the way, many of the critics did publish their responses in the peer-reviewed literature, and this dialogue took place. But what we saw is that just because they hadn't published their responses in the peer-reviewed literature didn't mean that those responses didn't have merit. And really, we can't use peer review as a tool to shut down debate and discussion, and in this case, dissent from the peer-reviewed literature. And this is where we need to be really careful. My article on Evolution News is not necessarily saying we need to do away with the peer review system entirely. I sympathize with people who say that the peer reviewed system is sort of the least bad option out there, and we need to have some way of monitoring the journals, making sure that they have good science being published. At the same time, we need to be careful how we use peer review, that we don't treat it as if it's some infallible gold standard, and we need to make sure that we allow people to have debate and dissent, even if it's taking place outside of the peer reviewed journals.
Yeah, what this reminds me of in some ways is regulation can be a good thing, and it's a necessary thing from time to time. But there does come a point where larger companies or political insiders that have a lot of undue influence can manipulate regulations through politicians in order to prevent competition. It's not actually to advance the industry or to preserve public safety in any way. It's just to block new competitors from entering the field. It's a similar kind of thing applied to the scientific community.
That's exactly right. I mean, the fundamental issue with the peer review system, as far as its flaw, is that there are conflicts of interest between the reviewers and the papers they're reviewing. Sometimes people have an interest to promote the paper when it might have flaws. Sometimes reviewers might have an interest to reject the paper even though it holds merit. And one of the biggest areas where that conflict of interest comes out is when the old guard defenders of a paradigm have a conflict of interest to reject a paper because it challenges that paradigm that those reviewers have built their whole careers, their whole economic bases of funding upon. There's a lot of interest there to not let new ideas into the peer-reviewed journals. And that's one of the biggest criticisms of the peer-reviewed system, is that it basically rejects new ideas. And that's why, as we talked about at the beginning of the podcast, there are so many examples where Nobel Prize-winning research or groundbreaking research was initially rejected by the peer-reviewed literature. Well, you have to ask the question, why is that happening? Well, Nobel Prize-winning research or new groundbreaking research, what's it doing? It's challenging the old consensus. It's challenging old views. And so it's not going to be received well by these peer reviewers who see it's their job to basically defend the orthodoxy of the old paradigm. And so now it all kind of makes sense. The reason why we see this peculiar phenomenon of the peer review literature system rejecting good research is because it has sort of a bias to reject research simply because it challenges old ideas, not because it's necessarily flawed.
How has peer review publication affected intelligent design proponents?
Now we're bringing it home to our debate. We sort of understand that the peer review system tends to reject papers that challenge the old paradigms. And in the case of the debate over ID and evolution, that's exactly what's going on. Darwinian evolution is the old reigning paradigm, and it basically is being defended in the peer-reviewed journals by a lot of people. And so when folks submit articles that challenge Darwinian evolution or promote intelligent design as an alternate paradigm, that's a real problem because, unfortunately, people sometimes just reject those papers simply because they're challenging the old Darwinian paradigm. One of the examples I talked about in my essay was an incident where Michael Behe submitted a paper for publication a few years ago, and the editor told him that they would not publish the paper. He said that, quote, "Your unorthodox theory would have to displace something that would be extending the current paradigm," unquote. And so Michael Behe concluded basically that if you are going to challenge the old paradigm, you're not going to be taken seriously by these journals. You're not going to be having the opportunity to publish, even if your arguments hold merit. And that's what a lot of ID proponents are facing, unfortunately.
You cited in your paper a 2002 declaration from the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which publishes the journal Science. The declaration stated, "The ID movement has failed to offer credible scientific evidence." Compared to declarations about other scientific controversies, what did a survey reveal that was so unique about this particular declaration?
First of all, you got to ask yourself, since when do scientific organizations issue press releases against scientific ideas? I mean, isn't that a little bit odd that a scientific organization is issuing press releases condemning certain ideas? I mean, this is not scientific behavior. This is political behavior. But if there's any doubt that the AAAS was somewhat uninformed when it issued this press release declaring that ID had failed to offer any credible scientific evidence, John West of the Discovery Institute actually contacted some of the people on the little committee at the AAAS that issued that statement. And he found that, unfortunately, some of the folks on that committee had condemned ID as unscientific without actually reading for themselves the academic books and articles by scientists who were proposing ID theory. So basically, some of the folks on the committee acknowledged that they themselves didn't know very much about ID. This is a classic case of folks who were defending the old paradigm doing so, and they're doing it not because necessarily that the challenging ideas lack merit, but simply because they're trying to keep the old guard paradigm in place. And unfortunately, that's what we saw here. The AAAS was simply defending the old Darwinian paradigm and trying to fend off new ideas like intelligent design, and they were not necessarily doing it because of the evidence, but just because they were trying to keep that old paradigm in place.
Casey Luskin, thanks so much for making the time.
Well, thanks for having me.
We hope you enjoyed this edition of ID the Future, a podcast of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Please consider supporting the Center for Science and Culture by going to idthefuture.com and clicking the yellow donate button. This podcast is copyright 2012, the Discovery Institute, all rights reserved.